Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Can you hear yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello.
There's a little knob here in case you want to adjust the volume.
Hello. Ooh.
Oh,
hi. I like mine loud.
Oh, this makes me want to be a DJ. Yo, what up, what up, what up? Today, Biggie Smalls, 20 years, we in Brooklyn represent.
Yo, yo, yo.
Oh, no heat. Wonder why Christmas missed us. Birthdays was the worst days. Oh, yeah, this is fun.
Hey, y'all, and welcome to Represent. I'm Aisha Harris, your host, and that was Journey Smollett-Bell and Amira Van, the stars of the WGN series Underground, and they were fooling around in our studio, rapping the illustrious stylings of the notorious B.I.G., who passed away 20 years ago last week. So on this episode, we're switching things up a bit, and my wonderful producer, Vera Lynn, will take a turn in the interviewer's chair as she recently sat down with Journey and Amira to discuss season 2 of the show. But first up, a brand new segment we're calling Recognize. Since this show began, I've had people throw out lots of suggestions for shows, topics, or people to cover, and so many of them have been really great ideas, but unfortunately, as we are but a weekly show, and as I am someone who writes about pop culture but can't possibly consume it all, we haven't always been able to give them the full treatment they probably deserve. So Recognize will serve as a space for some guests to drop by for a few minutes to briefly shout out a show, movie, or character they love or just find really, really interesting. So check it out, and here's our first installment with one of my lovely colleagues at Slate, June Thomas. Thank you so much, June, for coming on. You're making your Represent debut.
I am. It's very exciting.
So June Thomas, our lovely longtime, my lovely longtime Slate colleague, but now you are a managing producer of Slate Podcast. You've taken on a new role recently.
I have. I've got my headphones on all the time. My hair is constantly squashed.
But I'm so happy to have you on in this full capacity, and it's great to have you.
Thank you.
So we're here today to talk about the supporting character on American Housewife, yeah. Angela, who's played by Carly Hughes.
Yes.
Now, I've never seen the show.
Oh.
I'm not even really aware of the show, and I wonder how many of our listeners are as well. So if you could just give a brief little summation of the plot and how Angela fits into the plot.
So American Housewife is a show that when I describe it, I think a lot of listeners are going to go, what? But I swear, I find it's like one of my favorite sources of joy on television. So it's part of the ABC, what you might describe as the ABC diversity sitcom block.
Ah.
You know, it sits alongside Blackish and the Goldbergs and Fresh Off the Boat and Speechless. But this show is about white people in Connecticut.
Westport, Connecticut.
You know something about Aisha, yes. This
yes.
is specifically in Westport, Connecticut. And the sort of the friction of the show comes around the lead in the show, Katie Otto, who's played by the magnificent Katie Mixon. And the sort of the idea is that she doesn't belong. Her family doesn't belong. This is a town for rich people with a particular set of values which she doesn't share. And they're also all skinny and drink green juices. And she's a full-figured woman. And she just thinks a lot that they're shallow. And she's worried about her kids growing up in that environment. Mm. And so it's kind of, it's your basic fish out of water sitcom.
Right.
She really is full of anger. She's like actually kind of constantly boiling with rage, boiling over, being mean to people. But she has two friends who both happen to be women of color. They're played by Ali Wong, plays Doris, who's a super rich mom who's also super sarcastic. And then Angela, played by Carly Hughes, is, you know, she's a little snarky too. So Katie and Doris and Angela get together pretty much every day, it seems, have a second breakfast and just like talk smack about people in town.
So what is it about Angela that you like are drawn to? What makes her such a sharp sort of representation of, because Angela is a lesbian.
Yes.
But like you've talked a bit about in onslate.com.
Onslate.com.
About the way in which she sort of, her character is an improvement upon what we usually see for lesbian sidekick characters.
Right. So let me give a little background on lesbian sidekicks. Now, they've been around forever. We know them from, you know, Scooby-Doo, mm-hmm. Velma, or, you know, Peppermint Patty in Peanuts. So, like, we know these characters who, like, they have names, they have certain characteristics, but they don't have a lot of depth to them. And then in recent years, there's been this big trend toward lesbian sidekicks of color. And in my cynicism, which, you know, is not my best trait, I ascribe this to the fact that GLAAD does its report and shows get points for having both people of color and representations of things other than, you know, heterosexuality. And so you got a lesbian of color. It's a twofer on the GLAAD score.
Yeah, checking off the boxes.
Check, check. So, you know, we've had this whole army of lesbian sidekicks of color. There was this woman, Annalise, on Grandfathered. She was John Stamos's kitchen sidekick. Denise on Master of None, played by Lena Waithe, or Wythe, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce her name. And then Pippi on Rosewood, Rosewood's sister. So, you know, they're out there. But typically, they're not formed. They've got names. We know their names. They do things, but it's all in service of the main character. Now, this is also true of Angela. Angela, you know, hasn't had a huge amount to do, but at least we know something about her. We know that she is divorced from her former wife, that she kind of co-parents, you know, that they have kids together, they co-parent, but they broke up because Angela cheated on her wife. We know that she's an attorney. So, like, she has, like, we keep learning more about her. She's not just the lesbian.
Yeah.
It's not perfect.
What makes her not perfect?
So it's not perfect because, especially in the first episode when we met everyone, I mean, so, you know, your network pilot is a really high degree of difficulty. There's a lot to do, a lot to introduce. We met Katie and her family. She's got three kids and a husband. And Katie was going on and on about being the second fattest woman in Westport.
Oh, yes. I see that in the trailer.
Yeah. It's in the trailer. It's like it was said about 1,000 times in the pilot episode. And so Katie was trying to get someone who's bigger than her to move into an empty house across the street. And, you know, so that she wouldn't be the fattest woman in Westport or something like that. And so she got this woman to come. And then it turned out the woman was like a racist homophobe. So Katie made out with Angela in front of this potential buyer, so as to put her off the purchase.
I need to fix the mess I made next door no matter what it takes. But how do you get a racist homophobe to fall out of escrow?
Hi, Gail.
Hi, neighbor.
I would like for you to meet Angela, my wife and lover.
I've heard so much about you.
That was sidekick exploitation.
Yeah.
So that was not cool. And, you know, we still haven't seen Angela. We hear about her libido. So it's like she's not just a lesbian in name only, but she's also, you know, she's got no relationships that we know of with other women. So there's definitely a lot of room for, like, filling out.
Have we at least seen her family yet? Or
no, we have not. Huh. And, you know, I get that because that's just like a network casting thing.
Yeah.
You don't see characters on TV shows when they're not going to do much unless they're just going to be there for one time or something like that. So, you know, no, we have not seen anything. And that is starting to worry me. But it does seem to have caught on. And Angela and Doris are still very central to the show's premise. So I have hope that maybe she'll get a girlfriend who might actually get cast. Mm-hmm. And that would be amazing.
Well, it sounds like people should check out American Housewife if they're interested. Mm-hmm. Or is there a certain type of person who might like this?
Here's the thing. I am a little worried that people will watch the show and think, really? This is a show that you like? I think it is really like how you respond to Katie Mixon. I find her irresistible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every time I see Ali Wong, even though she's playing a character here, I do see a little bit of Baby Cobra, you know, her famous Netflix special. There's a sweetness to it. You know, Katie has three cute kids. She has a really nice marriage. You know, I would say, too, if you're maybe more than a size 4-6, you might get some pleasure out of this show. Like the feeling of rage of everybody being a size 2 and going on about their green drinks. It's a pleasant sitcom.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. Angela sounds like a really interesting character we should all be on the lookout for.
Yes, and I hope we see more of her soon.
So, Verilyn.
Hey.
Hey. So today I passed the baton to you. You recently sat down with the stars of Underground.
Yes.
And you're a huge fan.
I'll never forget like that weekend of after I watched it and I was like, Aisha, we have to. You don't understand.
And I was like, okay. So as listeners can probably tell, I have actually not watched the show or caught up with it yet. But this is why I had Verilyn come in, because she's a huge fan and there was no way I was going to be able to get to watch it in time for us to talk to Journey and Amira. So I'm glad to have you on.
Yes. And for listeners that don't know, Underground in season 1 tells the stories of 7 slaves who decide to escape the Macon plantation in Georgia and make what can only be described as the epic, heart-wrenching journey to freedom. And I feel like let's leave it there. Here's my conversation with Journey and Amira.
Yay!
Hi, y'all.
Hi.
I devoured season 1 in like a weekend.
Yes.
And I came back and I told Aisha Harris, who's the host of Represent on the Regular, like, yo, we have to do this. We have to talk about it. And it was right around the time of Birth of a Nation. And, me and Journey has already talked about like the slavery fatigue that was happening in that moment. And I guess the first question I want to ask you, when Misha Green, who is one of the creators of the show, and Joe Bukowski. I can see all the black names, but let me So when Misha Green and Joe Bukowski, who is
close enough.
I'm sorry, Joe, I'm sorry. approached you all and told you about the show and they told you it was on the Underground Railroad, what was your reaction? Were you like, cool? Or were you like, wait, I'm tired of slavery stories?
To be honest, I was skeptical. It wasn't Misha and Joe who approached me. It was my agent who said, Journey, here's the script. You know, we were negotiating for another show. And he was like, you know, you might want to read this other pilot. It's actually been picked up to series and it's one of the strongest pilots out right now. And when he sent it to me, I was like, really? How are they going to do this as a TV show? But once I read the first script, I was blown away. Mm. You know, I was blown away by the point of view, the perspective that Joe and Misha were taking. And it was bold. It was revolutionary. It was telling the story of those who disrupted the system, those who fought back. And I was like, wow, you know, we actually have never seen this story told. We have never seen the story of the Underground Railroad told in long format. And instantly, I had to be a part of it. I texted Anthony Hemingway, our executive producer and director. I had worked with him on True Blood, and I was like, listen, I'm Rosalie.
Okay. I don't know if you know yet.
I don't know if you know this, but... and I sent him like a long book of reasons why I was born to play her. Mm. And he just responded back with a snapshot of his pitching book that he had used to get the job with Misha and Joe. And next to the name Rosalie was my picture.
Wow.
Yeah.
That story still gives me chills. Wow.
I know, because what if it was someone else's picture? I mean, what
he wouldn't have texted you back. He'd be like, yeah.
He'd be like, cool. Send me your tape.
Yeah, I think, you know, the story is similar, really, across the board. I feel like every time we talk about it, you know, I tabled the audition because I don't do that. But I said, oh, I don't know, because of the times, you know, we had seen so much. And I said, I don't know that this is what I want to do. And then the writing and, you know, Journey said it all. So the only thing I'll add to what she said is the fact that the roles, you know, were so fleshed out and the female characters were so well-rounded, so strong.
And I don't think I've ever seen depiction of Black women enslaved on television with so much agency. Like, your choice, especially Ernestine, like, you play, so I didn't even tell people who you all play. So Journey, you play Rosalie, and Amira, you play Ernestine, her mother. And Ernestine, in my opinion, I know there's like a lot of debate online, but I feel like you gave up so much. You made so many choices to protect your children, and you were constantly making choice. And I know there are a lot of people that will say, you know, if you're an enslaved person, and I use enslaved instead of a slave.
So do we.
That you can't make choice, but I saw your choices every step of the way. And I don't think we've ever seen that, particularly from Black women on screen.
Most definitely. I totally agree. She did everything. I feel like there's never really a situation that a mama is not bending her, you know, trying and doing everything she can possibly do to try to afford a better life for their child. I don't care what situation you're in. So I'm with you. You know, I feel like even present day, you know, if you're broke, the mother takes two jobs. I have girlfriends who have, like, you know, she's like, girl, you know, I got me my second job. You know, I'm going tonight. Every mother in every situation over the years has always made, you know, extreme sacrifices. And when you talk about antebellum South, 1857, 58, you know, the extenuating horrific circumstances where life and death was on the line. It just, you know, their heroism just needs to be glorified even more.
And did you use, I'm curious about how you prepared for the roles. So as an English major, I read a lot of, I took everything with Black and woman in the title. So I read a lot of slave narratives, but I can count on my hand. Actually, it was only one when I was trying to think about, just from memory, the stories from Black women that I heard, and Harriet Jacobs' Incidents of a Slave Girl. It's like the only one I could really think of.
Well, there's a lot when you go back to the Library of Congress's collection of slave narratives. There's an amazing book that was kind of like my Bible on set.
Ooh, tell us.
Called The Bullwhip Days.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a collection of the narratives. And there's a lot of stories of women who fell in love, women who, you know, were the Ernestines and did everything they could to protect their children. And in this book, you know, they divide it into different chapters, and they talk about home life and the church, and they talk about religion. And it's incredible because you're able to get first person account of what it was like to be an enslaved man or woman from their point of view. Right. Mm-hmm. So not talking about them. Mm-hmm. It's their words. And, you know, I think that in itself is so helpful, and was helpful for us.
Oh, yeah.
Just to be able to understand from their mouth what it was like. Not it being a history book, not it being, you know, such a removed point of view. But when you get down to the nitty gritty, the mundane. Oh, they grew a garden outside their shacks to supplement the food that they, you know, the bare minimum food they were being given. Oh, they were given like one pair of shoes for the entire year. Or, you know, like all those details really helped us bring our characters to life.
And it's written in their dialect, too. So that's so, it just places you right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you hear the sound, and, you know, I'm very musical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's just like when you just
you
read
sing
it
on the show.
And so when you read, you know, when you read that, it has its own rhythm, its own life to it.
And depending on, you know, what part of the country they're from, it changes.
Like
the ones who were from Texas have a different dialect. And then, it's really great.
And so we're recording this the day after episode one of season two dropped. Mm. And I'm going to be upfront and say that I've already watched all three.
Trying to brag. Right. We ain't even see all three.
I know. So wrong.
And in this season, Ernestine, we won't give too much away, but you are now on a different plantation than the Mekong plantation, which is really where we meet you all in season one. And you're with the Gullah people.
Yes, got the Gullah Geechee Nation.
And
which is...
it's attached to, so I'm from Sierra Leone.
Oh, wonderful. And, exactly. And yeah, that's y'all people. Like, there you go.
Wait, this sounds like Creole, so I did a little of my Googles. That. And I was like, oh, there's a connection between
most
that.
Most definitely.
Like, talk a little bit about that. And so another thing I love about this is that there are so many moments where I'm like, I'm pausing and I'm Googling. I'm pausing.
Right.
Because there's just so many details. And you're like, did this really happen? Yeah. So speak a little bit about the Gullah people, which...
Oh, man. So the Gullah Geechee Nation is fantastic. We were honored to have Queen Kwet, who, she, if you Instagram or Twitter and all that, you know, she's an extraordinary resource on the Gullah Geechee Nation. And to find out, like, you know, it's another source of pride for us. Mm. A different system of how they operated as enslaved peoples. They were able to retain a lot of their culture because they were, it's a coastal, mm-hmm. you know, where they lived. And so often the white enslaved slave owners, they could not withstand, or really their bodies couldn't deal with anything that was coming over from the continent of Africa. They just didn't have the systems to be able to, which was actually good, because then they went to the mainland and then the people were able to actually retain their culture. And so it's still enslavement. It's still horrific. Still all of the same, atrocities were happening, but they were able to retain more of their culture because it was mostly them on the coastal island. And then so you see it in the colors. You know, our costume designer, Karen Wagner, was able to really, make that shine
it's
with all
so
the beautiful colors.
The blues,
oh, yeah.
The water.
It's such a contrast.
Absolutely.
To in the house where Miss Susanna was really saying, this is what I want it to look like. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that was really great. But also, the source of pride that I was talking about is like they went to Sierra Leone. They went to West Africa to say, you know what to do with these rice. You know, we want to create these rice plantations, and you know how to really cultivate this land. And, so they sought us for our skills. And so we developed America.
Wow. And I love the introduction of that into a story about the Underground Railroad and slavery, because I think a lot of times, unfortunately, the people's stories that we hear, even when we think about slave narratives, are the people that were able to get free and write and learn, right? So we don't, a lot of times, don't get to hear from the people that, like, just made the choice to stay. We all think that we would be the person that ran, right?
Right.
But most people, like, stayed and lived their life and made choices within that structure. And so it's good to hear a different story from that time that we don't traditionally get to hear from.
Yeah.
So let's bring some Elizabeth into this. I think Elizabeth, in representing, I think, the white abolitionist, the white woman abolitionist, to me is so interesting. We see her in episode one of season two go into the sewing circle, which, again, another moment where I paused, Googled, and I was like, wow, this was actually a thing where abolitionist white women, white and black, would meet up and take this opportunity to plan, to organize, to disrupt the system, which sounds like the average Black Lives Matter conversation that we will have right now. And, you know, in it, she's told that, you know, the silence around slavery is an extension of its brutality.
And we aim to put the issue into every northern home who refuses to see what's really happening.
Well, the narratives raise awareness.
And the rallies and the bake sales to raise funds and abolitionist prints like the Liberator. All forms of disruption. I have to believe that a true understanding of what the Southern Negroes are enduring will incite good people to action.
And I'm listening to this on Underground in 2017 for the first time. And the irony of that is not lost on me.
Right.
Like telling this story, like, why now? Like, why this moment? Especially, you know, when you think about last year, Django Unchained, 2012, 12 Years a Slave, 2013. You know, why now?
You know, I think the answer comes from Misha Green, who created this along with Joe, but she was the one who thought, you know, there's actually never been a long format story about the Underground Railroad, and she wanted to create it. And she said, you know, we had seen the occupation so much, we needed to see the revolution. Mm. I feel like we hungered to see a different side of our story told. We hungered to learn about those of us who did disrupt, who did organize, that spirit of revolution that we have now, where we say we matter. That didn't just, you know, come about now. It wasn't just invented recently. And that spirit of revolution we've always had. Yeah. We've always been saying we matter. And I think that's why people responded to it so positively of like, you know, like you're saying, you're Googling things, you're learning, and our spirits are hungry for this sense of pride. You know, it's unfortunate because there's so much shame attached to our history. When the fact is, we did nothing wrong, okay? It was done to us. And for some reason, there's so many of us who are like, I don't want to see that. I don't want to know about that. And this level of shame, I think we need to take away. And I think what Underground is doing is it's helping in that dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's helping contribute to another piece of our pie that was missing. And that piece was this story of us, of those of us who did fight back, honestly.
And I think in this period where, you know, the truth is so questionable these days, you know, and anyone can say, right, that people are hungry for the truth.
Yeah.
So with this point of in history, you know, this one storyline, you know, the beauty of having it on a TV show and a series is that we can go deeper and go farther.
We can explore the mundane.
We can, right. And so when you look at the story, you know, if you just kind of, you know, do a wash over it, you don't, you know, everyone's always like, oh, with the white hero and all that. And I love that about our story. Like, you know, you see what happens. I'm not going to say anything because I know people still tuning in. But the end of season one, the end of episode one, season two, last night, our premiere episode, people blown away. I think what's beautiful about it is that it was, like we said, all last year was this, the first integrated civil rights movement. It's a beautiful story of the nation coming together. And, exactly. And, you know, I was talking to someone actually yesterday, and it was really beautiful because we were saying, how do we keep our positivity and our hearts, you know, alive and awake and vibrant and in the state of the world as it's falling apart, you know? And I think one of the things that this period does for me, the way we're now looking at it, which I've learned just working on the show, is that no matter what atrocities were going on at the time and the group of crazy folks, you know, there was always a group of people fighting for change and fighting for progress and fighting to actually make the country represent what, you know, the Constitution and, all, you know, the Declaration of Independence were, what's it actually said and what it should actually mean for every American.
And putting their bodies on the line, right?
Right. And that's like, always, they've always coexisted.
Yeah.
So if you look at that, then you can say, oh no, this wasn't a sad story of there was no one fighting back, no one fighting for us, no one, we weren't fighting for ourselves. It's like, no, it's actually a complete opposite. And so that can continue and that will continue. And we see it with yesterday, Women's Day. We see it with the Women's March and men and women are there and young people. And so it's just like, that's been a constant. So it's like, don't despair. We've been in the fight, all of us together. Yeah, for a long time.
But, you know, as a show of like represents, you know, we get a lot of people that see this as a space to ask questions, white and black and all along the spectrum. And like one of the questions we get a lot is like, what is it? You know, we're talking about Get Out. I don't know either one of you have seen Get Out.
I have a 4-month-old, so I haven't seen many movies right now.
But one of the questions was like, there, you know, the girlfriend on there confronts a police officer with her black boyfriend. And in the show, we say, you know, that was kind of dangerous, like regardless of what was going on, like the fact that she did that showed that they probably weren't a good match, right? Because she's like mouthing off to the police officer and he's a black man and you know how that can go,
right?
And someone wrote in was like, well, I feel like she was acting as an ally. And, you know, then we have to do the explaining of like, what does an ally actually look like? And I feel like what we see in Elizabeth and John Hawks is like, people that are not just allies, they're invested. They see themselves as, you know, as an extension of this, like also being affected by this like system of brutality.
That's humanity. And that's humanity. Yeah. That's what's beautiful about our show. I feel like they're just telling a human story. That's why my character's flawed. That's why Rosalie's flawed. I mean, one of the best things I love about Miss, well, my daughter's not flawed, but
she did stab a little boy.
You know, you were high. Okay.
That's
they drugged
true.
You.
That's true.
Okay.
So Misha Green also worked on Heroes.
And so did Joe. That's how they met.
And they talk about, first and foremost, Underground being a thriller.
And that Rosalie is the superhero. Like, we see her origin story, and now she's, I mean, can we talk about episode two, right?
Yeah, because this airs next week after episode two.
This airs at next week episode two. And anyone that hasn't seen it, just skip a minute.
Yeah, just mute it for a second.
For a second. we see you in episode two. You know, you had just gotten three men into a boat,
yeah,
into the distance. And
because the plan changed. Harriet had a vision that it wasn't her transferring them, it was me.
Yes, and you trust your instincts.
Yes, yes.
And then we see at the end of the episode that you done everything we just saw you do, you were doing that very, very pregnant.
Very pregnant. Yeah.
That is not superhero-like.
Oh, she's definitely a superhero.
Yeah, Rosalie's pretty badass.
Yeah, and so is Journey.
And I like it because I think, like, you know, we talk about how much history is in this, but it's also, like, good storytelling. It's like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, look, the fact of the matter is this was the truth. There were pregnant women who operated within the Underground Railroad. There were women who strapped their babies on their backs and ran hundreds of miles barefoot. So, you know, Rosalie is living in a desperate and dangerous time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one could ask, well, why wouldn't she just sit down and wait and have this child? And that's...
I definitely asked that.
I'm sure there's going to be plenty of people being like, what is she doing? She putting that child at risk. But her idea of family does not end or begin with this child.
Yes.
It includes many other people, her mother, her brother, Noah. And
we don't have the luxury of time
in that
period.
And for the listeners,
Noah is played by Aldis Hodge, and he's the baby daddy. No, he's Rosalie's love, you know, and he's captured. And for her, it's exactly what you were just saying. It's like, there's no luxury. We don't have the time to just chill, you know, like there's this immediacy. There's this urgency to put the pieces back together. Mm. She's attained her freedom, but freedom ain't so free, you know, and
mentally. Yeah.
But she's also paid such a heavy cost for it. You know, she's lost every single person that she loves, and she cannot be free until they truly are free as well. Mm-hmm. And I think in her mind, you know, it's her idea of happiness, her idea of freedom is family for her. And so, you know, when she pictures this whole picture, it includes her mother sitting right there next to her and her baby. Mm-hmm. It includes Noah sitting right there next to her, you know, and I think nothing will stop her until she, you know, finds a way to put that back together. That's her mama in her, though. Mm. You know, Ernestine instilled, if nothing, she instilled a sense of love and family in her, you know, and you protect your family. You are devoted to your family.
Ernestine, though, is not lost some of her fire right now.
Oh, yeah. She's going through it.
And I think what I see in both, like, thinking about it in the superhero way and then also thinking about the love, thinking about the sacrifices, I feel like it presents a complex picture of Black womanhood. But are you ever afraid that it's also playing on some of the stereotypes of what it means to be a Black woman?
No.
Not at all. I mean, when I read the scripts for this season, all I saw was, again, human experience. Mm-hmm. I did not see color. I said, the beauty of season one was where so many people kept texting, oh my God, you remind me of my auntie, my mother, you know. And I felt, as soon as I read what the journey from Miss Ernestine was going to be for season two, I got excited because I said, women from all walks of life are going to say, I identify with that. Yes. I've struggled either with addiction or I've struggled with physical abuse, you know, and the fact that these writers are willing to tackle these issues that really, sadly, exist throughout history over time, exist right now, you know, and I think that's what makes it very relevant, you know.
Yeah. So I love, love, love the music throughout the show. Mm-hmm. Season one opens with Black Skinhead by Kanye West, and season two, of course, opens with Beyonce.
Right. Beyonce.
Come on.
Oh,
my
God.
We love you, Beyonce.
We love you, Queen B. You know, I was so excited when they told us, and we actually didn't find out until last week, that they officially got it.
Oh, wow.
Because there was like this uncertainty forever since Freedom came out. Mm. We were always like,
we want it, we need it.
Freedom for season two. Rosalie got to run to freedom.
Yes. We all have to run to freedom.
Right?
Put it in your headphones and get on a treadmill.
Seriously.
Don't you picture her talking to Blue about whether they should do it and Blue being like, yeah, mommy, go ahead.
Right.
Give them the freedom.
Right. And salons, too. Yeah. Let's do this.
And in both those montages, opening montages, people are actually running for freedom. Like, it's like, and you hear the heartbeat. It's so, like, I just felt so like I'm there with them. Mm. Who, I mean, besides calling up B, right? Who else, like, when you think about the music throughout the show and the scoring, is that like all John Legend, who's an executive producer?
We have amazing composers. Laura Cartman, award-winning Laura Cartman, and Raphael Sadiq. So real talk. Yes.
Raphael Sadiq from
Tony Tony Tone.
Has done it again.
No.
Tony Tone. And then Pearl. What was the group he had?
Pearl.
Coffee. My husband is going to be disappointed that I didn't know.
Coffee Stone.
He's going to be like, Judy, how did you not know that?
I'll play a little bit of it so people will know what we're talking about.
No, Raphael Sadiq is legendary and a legend. But yeah, he and Laura do the score.
Okay.
And so John Legend and Mike Jackson and Ty from the Get Lifted production company, they are our executive producers. And they do oversee, like, the music selections and stuff like that. But, you know, and then John Legend wrote an original song for season two called In America that plays at the end.
Which is everything. If you don't know it yet, go download. Real talk. Not even just because he's our EP. The song is fantastic.
Yeah.
Especially for right now.
Mm. Yeah.
Whew.
He also, you know, does a cameo this season as Frederick Douglass.
Oh.
Wait. She's like, what, for real?
Wait, it's from episode one?
I think it's episode 5.
Okay.
He's in.
Second to last question. My girlfriend's, I was telling Journey, my girlfriend's would kill me if I didn't ask a question about her 1996 film Eve's Bayou.
97.
Google told me 1996.
Google's wrong. We filmed it. We filmed it in 96. It came out in 97.
Okay, so you're 1997. I was 7. Yep, I was 7. Okay. And it's a coming-of-age classic for black girls. I think one of the only. There haven't been many coming-of-age stories with black
girls. There's a few. I mean, Crooklyn is one of my favorite.
For some reason, my mom let me watch Eve's Bayou, but she didn't let me watch Crooklyn. I couldn't watch many movies growing up.
Okay.
And I shouldn't have been watching Eve's Bayou.
Maybe not at 7.
No, it was like 7. I was 85. So I was, no, I was 12.
Yeah.
I was 12. I wasn't 7. Mama, I'm sorry.
Right. Mama's like, 7? Baby, you got me looking crazy on the air.
No. I was 12. Were you aware of how radical that character was, that role was at the time? And looking back, what do you think about Eve's role? And Eve is the character that you play on Eve by You. What do you think about her role in the history of film?
Man, you know, I certainly was not aware of it being anything radical. I just wanted to do, you know, a good job and do her justice. For me, you know, I could relate to Eve in so many ways. I knew her, you know, she felt like me in so many ways. And so, I was 10 years old, first of all. Whatever.
You really were 10?
Yeah, I was 10 when I turned 10 3 days before we started shooting. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, I wasn't aware of any of this being of any, like, substantial change or anything. Like, I was not aware of what we were doing in cinema, obviously. For me, my mom was my acting coach. Casey was and is one of the most incredible storytellers and visionaries that we have.
Casey's the creator of East Bayou.
Yes, Casey Lemons. And, you know, they really worked with me and tried to get me to understand the inner workings of who Eve was, which was really the first time, you know, that was happening with me as an actor. Like, I had been doing it since I was really little, but we weren't really diving into, like, inner workings. Okay. but yeah, you know, I think this was Casey's story. Mm-hmm. And I learned so much by working on this film, working with such legends like Sam and Lynn and Debbie and Diane. And
I rewatched it for this interview and it still holds up. Cause you know how sometimes you remember something fondly and then you go back and watch it and you're like, oh, dang,
yeah,
it's not as good.
Right.
Those performances are still as powerful. What did she tell her mom?
And where's Daddy? He's never home. He's supposed to be home sometimes.
Listen, you little ingrate. Your father works hard so we can have a house with four bathrooms.
Not every night he's not working. I know he's not.
Now, as an adult looking back at that, can't imagine being that precocious that I'm just going to say that to my mom.
Yeah, but you know, honestly, it was, and what's funny is my mom allowed us to be a, not to her, but we were, yeah,
distinction.
There's a distinction. Mm-hmm. But she allowed us to be very opinionated to adults. You know, we were always asked what we felt. And so for me, that's why I think I understood Eve. Mm-hmm. That's something I would have said, you know, not to my mama, because she would have smacked me. But, you know, I think for me, that film was the first time I realized I wanted to do this for the rest of my life. It was the first time I think I fell in love with the craft.
Mm. Do you remember, Amira, the first time you fell in love with the craft?
The first project I did, I guess. Mm. Yeah, it was in high school. And I was not, I was like, I was in Midwood High School in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And they have this thing called BHA, Black Heritage Alliance. And so my friends...
Was it February?
You know it was. You know it was. And so I got cast as Tina Turner because I had a lot of hair. It's a lot of qualifications.
Yes, come
you know?
Tina.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I want to see your Tina.
Honey, but honestly, I knew nothing about how to work on a character but just kind of approach it academically because I was a student like everyone else. Mm-hmm. So my only approach, which now I realize is dramaturgy. You know, but at that time, I had no clue what dramaturgy was. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of, Angela Bassett, still one of my favorite actresses. So I was just like watching the movie, reading about Tina Turner's life, you know, really getting into a character. And I think that's what I fell in love with. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it to be, because I was actually like, oh, God, what? I got to stand on a stage. That didn't appeal to me, which yeah. I actually love that entryway, because even now it's not about being seen. It's just about digging into these worlds. And that always excites me, into these characters and who they are and why they did what they did.
Well, the last question that we ask all our guests is, when was the last time you saw something on screen? So it can't be underground, something that you weren't involved in, that you felt represented by?
Oh. Hold on. I have an answer. I'm just trying to make sure that's the right one. That's what I want
to
say.
Well, I'm trying to go back to think of the films I've seen.
Well, I'll say, yeah. I'm going to just go with mine. I saw Moonlight.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know what I mean? Yeah, that's the most recent. You know, Terrell Alvin McCrane. Oh, my God. Right, I'm saying it. Sorry, Terrell. It's my boy. He's going to be like, really, Amira? But we did theater together, and he's so brilliant, you know? And I knew some actors in it, too. But that's not the point. The whole point is just that to hear that story, I feel represented because I just feel like it's a story in the world that I exist in and the people that I love. And so, and they haven't had the light on, you know, really shining on them in the way that it needs to be, you know, on that true love, on what that is. And I think, you know, exposure to get to know people, all these different communities, I think that's so important, because I think often a lot of the biases come because it's just ignorance.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know. They don't see what that is. So it becomes the other. And the other is so scary. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and that becomes dangerous. It's a beautiful thing that movie came out. And I'm just so proud of them that they were able to win an Oscar.
I know. And, you know, for me,
well deserved.
Yes.
I grew up with four brothers, you know, and so the idea of masculinity in our Black male community frustrates me. Like what it means to be a black man is way more complex, but our brothers are really boxed into this identity they didn't even ask for. And so I so appreciated what they explored with the definition of masculinity. And it's not even about sexuality. Like if you, even if you take that element of Moonlight away, because if you're straight or gay, if you are a young boy who's not as rough or right. as hard or as tough or, you know, not interested in certain things, you're judged, you're bullied, you're, you know, placed into a box. And for me, that is something I witnessed firsthand. You know, it's something that, you know, I talk even with my husband now having a son about really what are these gender definitions that we've inherited and what can we do about this? You know, why do we raise boys to be like, oh, you're a sissy? You know, why do we tell them this? Why do we say, oh, stop acting like a girl? Why do we, you know, we don't realize what we're doing and how we're rearing our children. And I so appreciated that commentary in Moonlight. You know, I could so relate to that in so many ways.
Our listeners will be no strangers. I feel like, oh, since Moonlight has come out, like 8 out of 10 people say Moonlight. It resonates with so many people. So our listeners definitely, there's no explanation needed as far as the storyline because they've heard us gush about it and they've heard other people gush about the impact of it.
But I'll say too, for me, like, you know, it shines a light on, we have to hold each other accountable.
Yeah.
And we have to demand more from each other. You know, that casual conversation that you have with your girlfriend that's just playing, that you go, oh my God, look at him. You know he gay. Like, we can't continue to take joy from other people's experience. You know, and I check myself often and I'm like, no, we have to check each other to say, you know, I want more for our community, our communities at large. I want more for myself. I want more for my children. I want more for my friend, you know, for my the stranger. They should be able to exist in however they are without having to be the brunt of someone's joke just to, you know. For the sake of just having a conversation, find something else to talk about and let people exist.
It goes back to what, you know, what you were saying as far as like people need to feel like it's not just a group, it's a person, you know, like and hearing someone's, knowing someone's story or caring about that person as an individual and not just seeing them as the stereotype and the monolith that is easier to curse or reject or talk about or disregard. Y'all got me all in my feels thinking about Moonlight now. It's early. How will we go out with our day? Thank you both so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
I feel like I have my like low Oprah voice now.
Yeah,
I didn't make either one of you cry. I feel like I failed her.
I'm tearing. I'm tearing.
Okay.
All right, that's a wrap. Thank you so much for listening to us, as always. And it was great to have Verilyn in on the interviewer's chair. It was great to listen to her talk to Journey and Amira about Underground Season 2. So check it out. And you should definitely check out Season 2 on WGN, which airs every Wednesday night. And, of course, thank you to June. It was really awesome to have you make your Represent debut to discuss American Housewife and Angela on the show. Be sure to head over to our Facebook page at Slate Represent to discuss any thoughts you had on the show, things we talked about. We'll be there. We'll be chatting, going back and forth with you all. It's been great to hear all of your thoughts on especially Get Out in the last few weeks, so keep them coming. And as always, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Megaphone, Stitcher, or any other place you find your podcasts. Also, you may have seen the hashtag Tripod, that's T-R-Y-P-O-D, lingering around your news feeds on Facebook and Twitter. You should definitely check it out. Tripod is a movement towards having people discover new podcasts, and you should share any new podcasts you're enjoying. Also, for those who may not be familiar with podcasts, you can help them figure out how to navigate the podcast world. And on our Slate show page, we'll direct you to some of my recommendations. I recently made a playlist for Radio Public that is centered around some of my favorite podcast episodes centered around politics and entertainment, including some episodes from Pop Culture Happy Hour and Code Switch. So you guys can check that out. That's my hashtag tripod. Represent is produced by the lovely, amazing Verilyn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai.
Andy Bowers is Chief Content Officer of Panoply, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Slate Represent. And the music you're hearing right now is performed by the sweet San Francisco funk soul band Midtown Social. Until next time.